Committee on Consumer Protection for the Oregon Legislature to order. It's Wednesday, May 9th, 2007. And looks like we're going to start out with Senate Bill 605. Is that correct?
Correct.
Senate Bill 605. Steve, give us a brief sentence or two about this bill, please.
Thank you, Chair Hull. The Senate Bill 605 makes a person engaged in the business of cleaning or servicing chimneys subject to licensure as a construction contractor.
Okay, with that, Senator, great to have you here.
Mr. Chair, very nice to be here. My name is David Nelson, State Senator from District 29, basically the northeast corner of Oregon, and Senate Bill 605 is brought to my attention by one of my constituents, Grant Darrow, who operates in a business out in that part of the country. There's some safety issues, and just wants to make sure that anybody that's cleaning chimneys does the good and proper job, and with that, I will turn it over to the people that actually know something about this. There's a lot of folks back here. I think the agency is in favor of this, and there's some issue about fees, but what's a heck of a fee here and there? Okay, if there's any question, I'd be happy to answer.
Fee there, fee everywhere, fee.
Yeah. Well, I think the fee is, they charge a fee anyway to clean it. This is just to make sure the people are licensed. If you're going to do it, you become licensed.
All right. Thank you for that introduction. Good to see you.
Hi, Representative.
Do we have a connection here with the person on the screen?
I've gotten his mail, sir.
Grant Darrow.
Yes, I'm on the video.
You certainly are. We can see you. So introduce yourself for the record and tell us a little bit about Senate Bill 605 and what leads you to talk about it.
Chairman Holding, members of the Consumer Protection House Committee, my name is Grant Darrow. I'm one of Oregon's senior chimney sweeps. I'm calling you from the campus of Eastern Oregon University in La Grande. I actually live in Elgin, north of here, about 25 miles. I went into business in 1977. I service an area of about 9,000 square miles with somewhere between 37,000 and 38,000 people in it, Union, Baker, and Wallowa counties. I requested Senate Bill 605 on behalf of the members of the Oregon Chimney Sweep Association. Very simply, Senate Bill 605 is simply a statutory fix to an administrative rule change that wiped out a 20-some-year requirement that chimney cleaning requires a contractor's license. One of the things about being a senior in any business is you kind of become a historian by default. So I'd like to just kind of give you a brief historical rundown that brought us to this committee today. In 1977, when I first started cleaning chimneys, there were absolutely no requirements for chimneys. It was shortly after the oil embargo, and the use of wood stoves was very popular. After several years in business, it dawned on me that some minor amounts of liability insurance wouldn't just protect me, but it would protect my customers. The irony is, when I the first insurance I got, adjusters didn't know how to classify me, so they stuck me in the same category as hotel maids, one that cleans. In the early 1980s, the Builders Board, which is what the CCB was in those days, began assessing civil penalties against people cleaning chimneys, chimney sweeps, for activities that they were doing during the course of chimney sweeping that the Builders Board felt qualified them as contractors. This resulted in a lot of hearings and actually an appeal before the Oregon Court of Appeals for judicial review. And in the end, we all agreed, everybody who was attending these meetings, that people in the activity of chimney cleaning really did need to be licensed, bonded, and insured. And so in the administrative rules, the sentence chimney and flue cleaning was added to activities qualifying you as a contractor. It's kind of, back in 1982, we estimate that maybe one out of two structural fires in single family and one in two family dwellings was caused by improperly installed and maintained solid fuel heating appliances. We've come a long way since those days. And at the forefront of that have been Oregon's chimney sweeps, because we're the people in Oregonians' homes. In 2005, Kathleen Doblin, and I have to excuse if I get people's names wrong, she's in a senior AAG general counsel, made a ruling essentially that what she did is she went to Webster's Dictionary and looked up the word cleaning and determined that cleaning did not require a contractor's license. And to the best of my knowledge, she never consulted a chimney sweep or a chimney sweep guild or association about what constituted a chimney cleaning. She did make one point that was quite legitimate, that we can't use administrative rules to tweak statutes. So in 2006, the Oregon Chimney Sweep Association, just prior to our general membership meeting that year in Bend, were told that if you only clean chimneys, they weren't required to get a contractor's license. The fact of the matter is, what I did at that point is I put together a letter to Craig Smith. I contacted Craig Smith at the CCB and tried to explain that basically when you're cleaning a chimney, you're performing an inspection. You may have to alter things to access the chimney. And Craig asked me to write a letter explaining what constitutes chimney cleaning. And there before you today, if it hasn't been entered, it will be before the end of this meeting, is my original letter to the CCB that I drafted up in about 10 sweeps from around the country, edited, and it's based upon my 30 years as a chimney sweep and some of the situations I find myself in during routine chimney cleaning. So that's what's brought us to this point. I contacted my senator, David Nelson, and between him and Craig Smith of the CCB, we developed this language. It's a simple insertion of the word or to clean and service chimneys into existing statutes with a paragraph at the end that allows anybody that has indeed gone into business this year has time to get themselves licensed, bonded, and insured. Where we're at right now, as I've pointed out, chimney cleaning involves inspecting, installing, alternating, and repairing at some point during the course of the day. This current rule change has essentially created two classes of chimney sweeps in Oregon, regulated and unregulated. This rule change is surely unenforceable. Unlicensed chimney cleaners will not be allowed to verify the suitability of a chimney for continued use because to do so constitutes an inspection. Chimney sweeps sell safety. Almost every job when I get done, the homeowner wants to know if the system is safe for continued use. And we feel that the health and safety of Oregonians are threatened. And one of the big issues that we saw in the early 80s is this opens it up to out-of-state companies coming in and running boiler room operations if there's no regulation. Chairman, I appreciate the opportunity to speak to you. If there's any questions, I'd be happy to try to answer them. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Darrow, and hope it's a beautiful day up there in LeGrand. And I appreciate Eastern Oregon University for helping you communicate with us from that part of the state. It's a really great thing. Any questions for Mr. Darrow from the committee? It doesn't appear we have any questions for you. We don't have a copy of that letter that you sent to Craig Smith at this time, but he's in the audience, so he'll probably be able to fill us in on that list of things that chimney sweeps do, and I appreciate you being proactive and sticking up for your industry and bringing this issue forward. Looks like a good issue we should take action on. Thank you again.
Thank you.
With that, maybe I'll bring up Craig Smith and Donna Dish, I believe.
Chair Holby and members of the committee, Craig Smith, Construction Contractors Board, appreciate your opportunity to address you today regarding Senate Bill 605. I'm the administrator of the Construction Contractors Board, and I'm passing out a little presentation and for your review. I'd like to first thank members of the chimney sweep industry for being proactive regarding this matter. I can explain to you what happened if you're interested in knowing. Or I can, at very least, cut to the chase, which is we feel as though this is a good idea. We think this reduces confusion. This clarifies that people involved with the chimney cleaning industry need to be licensed with the CCB. I know of no opposition to the bill. We do have a small issue that arose when I look at the bill for the about the 10th time today and saw a word in the bill on line number 10, wherein it changes the definition of a contractor to include the operator of a general contractor. And I frankly am unclear as to what that means. And I did not write it, and I need to talk to legislative counsel and talk to AG's office to ease my concern about what that might do to the other 45,000 licensed contractors. So my testimony is, sir, that we appreciate the bill. We understand. We appreciate the intent and support it. And I'd like to have an opportunity to talk with legislative counsel about what they meant when they wrote that language.
Thank you for that and your caution about that word too. Doesn't really seem to fit to me either. Questions? Let's split Ms. Dish. I said that right.
You did great.
Okay.
Yes. Chairman Holby and members of the committee, my name is Donna Dish, and I am with the Office of State Fire Marshal. We certainly applaud the proactive efforts, and we know of no opposition to this bill at all. What we do know is about chimney fires. That's one of the things that we do know. And we know that the cleaning of a chimney, creosote buildup, or any kind of debris from a chimney makes a big difference. So do faulty chimneys. Each year we have, and you'll see in our testimony here, well over almost 5,000 chimney fires per year. That's over the last 8 years, that's about 600 per year. That's a lot of chimney fires. And if you add to that, the property losses are substantial from these kinds of fires. Add to that the fact that these fires are going to occur in late fall and early spring when it's cold outside. So a fire such as a chimney fire will literally leave a family out in the cold. And these fires can be very, very devastating. So we certainly support their efforts and ask you to do the same.
Thank you for that. And I know chimney fires are a big issue with older homes as well. Representative Gerard, question?
Thank you. I have a couple questions. The first being, how much education are we going to require them to get their contractor's license? How much fee are we going to be charging? And how much of a barrier to entry is there going to be? Those are all my three questions.
Okay. Chair Holvey, members of the committee, Representative Gerard, the most direct answer is almost none because, to my knowledge, I know of no legitimate businesses that are currently unlicensed. So most of the businesses that exist today are currently licensed. They've been licensed because heretofore, until a few months ago, Builders Board or Contractors Board rules required people engaged in this business to be licensed. So they're in the system. As Grant testified, while we are on some other business, our good lawyer, who retired recently, may her soul be blessed, told us that there was a problem with that rule. And what she told us is, I'm not certain that you have statutory authority to have a rule that you currently wrote that says, from 1990, that chimney sweeping businesses must have a contractor's license. Based upon that ruling from the AG's office, we relaxed our rule in accordance with what we believe the statute says, so we indicated that businesses that are engaged in inspection or businesses engaged in any kind of repair, which the current statutes allow, of which most chimney cleaning businesses engage, those businesses need to be licensed. So today, I think most businesses are licensed. But the good folks at the chimney in the chimney cleaning industry raised a red flag, and that is, by changing your rules, CCB, you could add confusion to the marketplace. And we think, as an industry, people engaged in just cleaning chimneys, even if that's all they did, they ought to have a CCB license. So to answer your question directly, it will not change the rules at all. Businesses that come in new, their chimney cleaning businesses, will have to have a CCB license where they take a test based upon business practices, not chimney cleaning. They would pay the exact same fee as any other construction contractor as they have in the past. That fee, as you know, is about $130 a year.
A follow-up, Craig. So chimney sweeps will be licensed as general contractors, or is there a special chimney sweep license?
Chair Holby, they would be licensed as one of the seven categories that we currently have. The two that come to mind that make sense would be either as a residential contractor only, general contractor, or specialty contractor. Any one of those categories would work. I haven't done a check to see, but most of those contractors, they can tell you how they're currently licensed.
Okay. So they could be licensed as a general contractor, specialty contractor, and anything else. Which
okay. Illegal.
Further questions from the committee? Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What kind of training does a chimney sweep have to get into the business?
Chair Holby and Representative Bonamici, I don't know. And we don't demand any competency testing today for chimney sweeps. As you know, we've had before the committee some legislation that would require some competency testing for building envelope contractors. But today, a construction contractor has no competency testing, and tomorrow, if this bill passes, a chimney person would not require any competency testing either. It would just require that the chimney cleaning business pass the CCB test, which is a business practices test, so they know what laws to obey, and carry insurance and carry a bond. And the idea behind this kind of regulation is that the marketplace dictates what kind of training that business needs to get to provide a good service. And of course, a lot of professional associations provide this training.
Ms. Dish, along those lines, does the state fire marshal offer any kind of, I guess, helpful hints for chimney inspection, or do they have any kind of, literature or guidelines or information that's available to this organization that might help them identify potential problems from the fire marshal's point of view?
To my knowledge, we have nothing other than what we have for the public. And those things that we have for the public really talk about the accountability. And certainly the things that Craig has talked about provides a line of accountability where you'd be able to trace somebody that came out to your probably residence, although some businesses also have chimneys. The basic things that we tell them is that any kind of substantial crack or deviance from the soundness of the chimney will also create a problem for a chimney fire as well. We have some other things regarding installations of chimneys. We do have some guidelines along that line. But as far as just cleaning the chimney itself, we don't have anything along that line.
And Craig, same question from the CCB's point of view. Do they have anything specifically around chimney construction, maintenance, or things that are available to chimney sweeps?
Chair Holby, I've got to tell you that I know of none.
Okay. I imagine building codes probably has information about chimney
installation
and what proper clearance should be and all those sorts of things. Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Craig and Donna, Thank you for being here. Wouldn't it be difficult to, I mean, how could you clean a chimney and not see something that need to be repaired? So basically, why don't we just require this license of anybody who signs up to be a chimney sweep, like a doctor or teacher?
Chair Holby and Representative Nelson, I think you get at the nut of this bill. I think that's exactly what the authors meant, was to make it very clear that people engaged in this business of cleaning chimneys ought to have a CCB license at minimum.
And one other question. So if they're licensed as a specialty contractor, their liability insurance and bonding requirements would match those of a specialty contractor, or likewise with a residential or general contractor?
Chair Holby, that's correct.
Okay. Any other questions?
Can I just ask one quick question?
Sure.
I'm sorry if I didn't listen. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Did we decide how much this license costs? I did not hear that.
Chair Holby, Representative Nelson, the license fee for construction contractors is a flat fee. It's $130 a year. Today, the minimum license is 2 years. Some people choose to get a four-year license.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony today. Been looking forward to hearing this bill. And up next, we have some Chimney Sweep Association people. Scott Hess, Chris Winslow, James Runkow, and Carrie Jones. Maybe we can drag an extra chair and you all four can come up. Thank you, gentlemen, and if you could just somebody go first and introduce yourself for the record.
My name's Chris Winslow. I am currently the president of the Oregon Chimney Sweep Association and have owned a chimney cleaning business for almost 25 years here in Lane County. Chairman, Representative Holby and the committee, in the name of public safety, OCSA supports Senate Bill 605 and the need for chimney technicians to be licensed through the CCB. To kind of clarify, everybody here and every chimney sweep I know, and it's a requirement to belong to this association, we are all have been on since, I believe, about 1986. That's when there were problems in the industry with accountability and required chimney sweeps to be licensed through the CCB. 20 years, or almost 20 years, went along just fine, and then just almost exactly a year ago, we by way of just reading the CCB newsletter, it said chimney sweeps no longer need a license. And it just really threw us, amazed us, when most states are moving towards more requirements, that they would drop the need for licensing. And Grant and others may bring up all the reasons why it's so important in the process of a cleaning. Even if we don't do repairs or installation to clean, sometimes we have to take part of the chimney apart and put it back together. And it's very important to be knowledgeable with standards in the industry. You also asked about, you know, rules we go by. We are not required to do anything other than be a state licensed contractor, be bonded and insured. However, we do have a voluntary certification program through this association, and there's voluntary certification programs through the National Chimney Sweep Guild. And we do go by, have standards in the industry. One is the National Fire Protection Association Code 211, which has standards for solid fuel burning appliances that is our Bible that we go by, which closely relates to the International Residency 1 and 2 Family Dwelling Code Book for the state of Oregon that regulates all contractors, and that does have specifics in it regarding chimneys. And so, and then beyond that, for installing a stove, there are manufacturer's specifications that we have to go by. And then further, to install stoves, we pull permits to, just like you would to build a home or to do an addition to a home, we have to pull a mechanical permit through our county to clean chimneys. So the days of just looking, putting on a top hat and singing and running a brush down through the chimney are long gone. This has become a very technically requiring industry for us to be up to standards, and to all of a sudden, just because of a wording change 12 months ago, that all of a sudden looked like chimney sweeps didn't have to be registered, have any education or any accountability, just didn't seem like it was headed in the right direction for us. So we're not asking to change anything other than just back the way it was 12 months ago when this ruling took, when this ruling, it sounds like by all consensus, by accident, took effect. And we're just trying to get it back to where we were last year and where we had been for 20 years. It's not like we're doing something new here. Anyway, and so I've, any questions? Or that's your job.
Oh, you did fine.
Does anybody have any questions?
Thank you all for being here. I wonder if you could talk about what kind of, how you get your training and what you go through to, because the CCB, as Mr. explained, the CCB license is business practices. How do you train to do the job that you do?
Is that to me? Can we go to it next, Scott?
Just say your name first.
I'm Scott Hess. I live in the area, Silver Creek Chimney Sweep. Chairman Holby and committee members. Basically, most of us, I'm a senior also, senior sweep. Most of us started out cleaning friends' chimneys, just getting into it and just
job.
Just on-site, on-job, work-related experience. Nowadays, what the Oregon Chimney Sweep Association and the National Guild try to do is encourage sweeps to get certified. And in that, we have a very detailed certification program and testing that shows you what to do, how to do it, and what to avoid and what to look for. And basically, it is guided by the NFPA 211 code standard book and the International Residential Code book here in Oregon that has been adopted.
Thank you.
So it sounds like the questions I was asking of CCB and the state fire marshal about materials that would help chimney sweep and identifying what the best practices are, that your association is pretty much proactively already doing that.
Yes. May I add that every year when we new sweeps get certified and we recertify, we send a list to the state fire marshal's office, so they have a list of all the certified sweeps in areas around the state.
Oh, that's great. Representative Gilliam.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Hess, how long have you been in this business?
I've been in for about 28 years.
And where is it that you choose to apply your trade?
Most of my customers are in the Silverton area.
Silverton area. And do you enjoy that part of the state, do you?
These are real quick for follow-up, aren't they, Mr. Chair?
And Mr. Chair, I'm not sure where the representative is going to be.
Are these germane to the bill?
Well, certainly. Okay. Well, I just...
Follow-up, Representative
Thank
Gilliam.
You, Mr. Chair. I just would commend you for your choice of trade and your location, and I'd also like to say you do good work.
Strange. Thank you, sir. Did you know him before?
You have a chimney, Representative?
Several, and this man has cleaned them.
Okay.
Yeah, we still got to talk about that brick. Okay.
And declare a conflict of interest now or on the floor? Representative Nelson.
Yes, I wanted to thank you for being here, and also, I had a huge tragic event at my house, and thank God for, he was from Salem, but I don't know who, I can't remember his name. A chimney sweep came over and took the birds out of mine after my house nearly burned down. Certainly was black with smoke. But, you know, this is, I'm kind of concerned because for the safety, it appears to me this is a very dangerous job. And so I'm just curious, we talk about training and so forth, if you have specific what's the word, uniforms or tools that, you know, that keep you safe? Do you, Chris?
We definitely, for instance, our ongoing yearly training and our convention, which is a four-day training session on current topics, and we do have people, representatives from OSHA, to address safety and climbing. We constantly go over creosote's a known carcinogen. It's something that we're cautious of breathing as a profession. Last year we had a guy from Pacific Power to do a demonstration at the meeting regarding safety and ladders around high power, high voltage. So we play heavily on the safety of this profession.
Good. Thank you.
Well, I'm going to try to keep this committee moving. The other two gentlemen, I don't know if you have anything to add for the record, or... Okay.
I can. But I
sorry. Well, I appreciate brevity as well, and so I appreciate the Chimney Sweep Association, you gentlemen, coming forward and bringing your issue to the legislature. Go ahead. You need to introduce yourself for the record.
I'm Kerry Jones of Jones Services in Eugene, Oregon, also a member of the Oregon Chimney Sweep Association and regional representative as well. Chair Holvey and members of the committee, I just want to state that this, in cleaning a chimney, there is more involved in cleaning. We end up looking at it, and I believe the CC rules state that you must be a licensed contractor to inspect. And this is just an amendment for the apparent error in the rule changes that went on a year ago. I support this bill. I think it's...
Thank you for that. And, you know, it looks like chimney sweeps come from good districts. So...
let's see where the other one's from.
with that, I think I'm going to call up another...
He didn't identify
himself.
The other one.
Do you want to identify yourself for the record and say something?
Certainly. Representative Holvey, thank you for the opportunity, chair members.
Speak into that microphone.
That's good.
My name is James Brunkel. I sweep chimneys in Portland. I also agree that this is a good rule change. We need to be licensed.
Great. Appreciate you gentlemen coming forward and bringing us this legislation and being proactive in your industry. It's great. It is, sometimes people think of it as a kind of a laughable topic and a laughable job, but it really is a serious and important and really does have a huge effect on the safety of a lot of people. So I appreciate your expertise and your trade. So with that, I've got one more person I'd like to bring up to testify. Just sent a card up, Steve Buckstein, I believe.
Steve Policy.
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, I actually am here to testify on a later bill today, but listening to the testimony, I just had a question.
And can you identify yourself directly?
I'm with Cascade Policy Institute, Steve Buckstein with Cascade Policy Institute in Portland. Just had a question maybe for you to consider, since this is the Consumer Protection Committee and not the Industry Protection Committee. And sometimes there's a conflict. And when I heard the testimony that there are, on average, the last few years, 600 chimney fires a year in Oregon, apparently the State Fire Marshal's Office doesn't have data to say how many of those chimneys had not been cleaned for a long period of time. They indicate that fires generally occur in dirty, very dirty chimneys or cracked chimneys. And my concern, and I'm neutral on the bill, I'm not against the bill, but I just want you to consider that anything that raises the price of chimney cleaning, chimney sweeping, chimney inspecting, or reduces competition in that industry, you'll tend to see possibly more fires, not less, because people will be less likely to have their chimneys cleaned and inspected. So I would hate to see an unintended consequence, and I'm not saying this bill does that, but if there's too much regulation, too much cost to get into the business, as one of the chimney sweeps indicated, he started by, you know, cleaning friends' chimneys. The more that you limit entry to the field, It may raise the income of the people already in the field, but it may actually harm consumers who then don't get their chimneys sweeped or cleaned when they should, and you might end up with more fires rather than less. So that's all. I just wanted you to consider that.
Well, thank you. That's certainly an interesting point of view, and you know, I think a little bit of regulation is important, though, because we certainly wouldn't want chimney sweeps cleaning chimneys with gasoline or something like that, too.
Of course.
You know, it does take a little bit of both, I think, to make the world work. Appreciate your comments. Questions? With that, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 605, and I believe I'll hold this over until Mr. Smith had a chance to talk to Legislative Council to make sure we're not having any unintended consequences with the language in this bill. And as soon as we're comfortable with that, we'll bring this bill back and move it on to the next stage in becoming law. So with that, I would like to open. I'd like to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 613. Steve, give us a little summary of Senate Bill 613, please.
Thank you, Chair Holvey. Senate Bill 613 requires that a written instrument assigning mortgage show the name and address of the assignee.
Sounds pretty simple. We have up Paul Levesque.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Paul Levesque. I'm management analyst for Tillamook County, and I also manage county-owned properties. I'm president currently of a group called the Oregon Public Property Managers Association, made up of folks from other counties who basically perform the same function, primarily with tax foreclosed properties. The bill is a very straightforward bill, and the reason, though, is very important, I think, particularly from a consumer affair point of view. As the county has the obligation to undertake tax foreclosure each year, we are required to notify not only the owner of the property, but also anybody with an interest in the property, particularly lien holders, 1 year prior to the end of the redemption period. Increasingly, there are many assignments of trust deeds that do not contain the address of the assignee, and this bill would require that. The consequences of that are twofold. Number one, if we are unable to notify that person of the pendency of the proceeding, they are unable to come in and pay the taxes to protect their security interest in the property. If they fail to do so, at the end of the redemption period, the property is deeded to the county and they lose their security interest in the property. It does not carry forward to another owner. And more importantly, then when the county turns around to auction off the property, property managers throughout the state often work with title companies and buyers to move them into a title insurance policy. In order for title companies to issue the policy, they want to look at our tax foreclosure proceeding and make sure that we've provided all the notice that we're required to do. And in a case where there was no address on the assignment of trust deed and we were unable to notify that party, then they will not insure title on that property. So what is happening is that there is an increasing body of tax foreclosed property that is now out there in the private sector, which is uninsurable from a title standpoint. As far as this bill goes, we began working about a year ago, primarily with the County Clerks Association, but with the tax collectors and assessors, and we contacted the Oregon State Real Estate Section. and there was no opposition to the bill from anyone. When it had its hearing on the Senate side, apparently the Oregon Bankers Association weighed in favor of the bill. Yesterday, however, I received a call, actually for the past 2 days, a number of calls from a group of attorneys representing creditor and debtor section of the Oregon State Bar. And they had a concern about the bill in that it purported to amend Chapter 86, which contain the substantive and procedural provisions relative to foreclosure of mortgages and trust deeds. Their concern was that if a county clerk might someday forget to look and see if the address was there, and then the borrower under that instrument later defaulted on their loan and the lender had to foreclose, the borrower's counsel might raise as an affirmative defense the fact that because the assignment did not have an address, it was therefore invalid. So the attorneys representing the creditor-debtor section of the bar are proposing that we make an amendment, and I've checked with all the folks that have been involved so far, and move the requirement out of Chapter 86 into Chapter 205. And I guess I didn't keep a copy for myself, but I gave the package to the committee assistant, and hopefully you would have that. Thank you. Thank you very much. The provision, if it were moved to Chapter 205, joins already a list of recording requirements that have to be included in the first page of a document when it's recorded. And so I guess I would be asking, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, if you would consider substituting this provision for what presently exists in the bill. In talking with the members of the state bar, they felt that, for what it's worth, the relating clause of the measure was sufficiently broad to allow you to make that substitution, but I leave that to this committee. Now, Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
I have a question, Mr. Chair.
Representative Bonamici.
Thank you. I'm sorry if I missed a piece of this. If the borrower's attorney could raise as a defense the invalidity because there was no address under Chapter 86, why couldn't they do the same thing under Chapter 205?
Because Chapter 86 are the procedural and substantive provisions, and I'm not a lawyer, but as it was explained to me, provisions of mortgages and foreclosing on mortgages. Chapter 205 is merely a recording statute.
And Representative Bonamici, if I may, Mr. Chair.
Representative Riley.
It does say any errors in the cleaver sheet shall not affect the transaction contained in the instrument itself.
In the proposed language?
Yes.
But, Mr. Chair, how can we change it when the relating clause refers to ORS 86?
Well, because the relating to clause will stop right there at...
You can change the statute reference in
right,
relating
relating to the assignment of mortgages.
Mm.
Yeah.
So, well, let's take that under advisement, and we'll see if we can hammer that out with legislative counsel and see, is there anybody else that would like to testify on this late-breaking development on Senate Bill 613? Nobody from the bar or the bankers or anybody else that has any thoughts on this issue, whether it's necessary or not?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is David Niebel. I work for the Oregon State Bar. I followed the email discussion between Mr. Levesque and members of the debtor-creditor section, and I believe Mr. Levesque has explained the agreement and the need for this amendment adequately. The debtor-creditor section is in favor of this amendment.
Okay.
Thank
good,
you.
Good enough. I appreciate you coming forward. No other questions from the committee. We'll looks like we'll carry this one over too. So with that, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 613. And next up, we're going to open a we'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 118A. Okay. Steve, give us a reminder of this bill. I think we previously heard it.
Thank you, Chair Holvey. Senate Bill 118A authorizes the governor to declare an abnormal disruption of the market under specified circumstances.
And I have signed up to speak Steve Buckstein.
Good afternoon again, Chair Hovey and members of the committee. Again, my name for the record is Steve Buckstein. I'm Senior Policy Analyst and the founder of Cascade Policy Institute in Portland. I believe that imposing price controls to protect consumers is one of the worst things that government can do in an emergency. Rapidly rising prices signal those outside the affected area, outside of Oregon or outside of the part of Oregon where this emergency occurs, to conserve scarce resources. And they also, these rapidly rising prices, also signal producers to ship more of those products into the area quickly. Price controls, the kind of control that you're talking about in this bill, short-circuit these signals, turning a natural disaster into a political one. I just want to give you one example. I've provided written testimony and a commentary that one of our associates wrote actually 2 years ago when a similar bill was being considered before the legislature. And again, since this is the Consumer Protection Committee, I want to make sure that in your deliberations you're protecting consumers and not harming them. So imagine a catastrophic storm hitting Oregon like the one that I lived through and some of you probably lived through, the Columbus Day storm in 1962. The windows in your house are broken and the rain's pouring in. Everyone's scrambling to board up damaged buildings. An emergency, the sort of thing that this bill would apply to. Without this bill, overnight the price of plywood, as one example, in Oregon or in the affected part of the state, would skyrocket. The sudden high prices send a message to casual consumers of plywood who aren't affected by the catastrophe. The message is, conserve plywood. Don't buy right now because the price is too high. At the same time, the spike in prices sends a message to producers, to brokers, to retailers, people in the supply chain, that we need plywood in Oregon, and we need it very fast. So the faster they get it here, greed comes in here, and going back to the movie, you know, in this case, I think greed is good. The quicker that producers or suppliers or retailers can get plywood into the affected part of Oregon, the more profit they make before those prices naturally come back down as the crisis is over. So the interests of the consumer and the producer are aligned through the price system. Casual users of plywood will reduce their purchases because of the high prices, allowing those who have a critical need, the broken windows, to find the product, even if it's at much higher prices that they would think would be quote-unquote unconscionable, as the bill talks about, in normal times. But in these circumstances, they'll be happy to find it at virtually any price. Now imagine that this bill becomes law, and we have this storm, and the governor applies the law to keep plywood prices from rising. Stores in the area would quickly sell out because the demand greatly exceeds the supply at the fixed price. That's the law of supply and demand. Imagine homes being severely damaged and homeowners not being able to buy a sheet of plywood at any price. So while some Oregonians' property is being destroyed in this example, consumers in other parts of the state or consumers nearby, like in California or Washington, might be blithely going along buying plywood at the protected price for things like playhouses for their kids or you know, normal construction. And they would get what they want, and the people needing the help in the disaster wouldn't get what they want because you short-circuited the, the supply and demand system. So under this scenario, I just want to ask you, who are you protecting? Are you protecting the consumers, the people in the disaster, or are you actually hurting them by short-circuiting that law? And it is a law. It's called the law of supply and demand in economics. And I think that law is actually a better friend of consumers in a disaster than the law that the kind of law that you're talking about passing in this building. So, I just want you to consider the unintended consequences of this law, because you can't negate the law of supply and demand. There are consequences when a legislature passes a political law. The law of supply and demand still maintains, and you'll still run into, in many cases, critical shortages. Thank you. I'd be glad to take any questions.
Thank you. Questions? Representative Riley.
Maybe more of a comment, Mr. Chair. Most of the merchants that I know, if they run out of the plywood and they're making a profit, will get more plywood to sell. And I think the supply and demand will still work. What won't work is price gouging.
Well, again, is that a question?
Was that a question? I don't think that was
no,
a question.
No, I said it's more of a comment.
Representative Gerard, question or a statement?
I actually have a fair amount of, I took quite a few college classes in economics, and I would concur with what was being said. But I also wanted to get his opinion on a section of the bill on page 3, lines 3 through 4. Not only are we trying to interfere with the market, but what we're giving the governor is a real broad sword to when to declare the emergency, and that bothers me probably as much as the economics that are involved. Have you read?
Yes, Chair Hovey, Representative Gerard. That is a concern. Actually, I signed up to oppose the bill. I don't have as much problem with the governor being able to declare an emergency, because that sends a signal also. I mean, just by itself, the news media is pretty good at telling people, outside the surrounding area that an emergency has happened. But with the part of the bill that allows price controls, giving that carte blanche to the governor to declare an emergency, I think, is a bad idea. If you would simply, a friendly amendment, if you would remove the part about capping prices and simply allow the governor to declare an emergency, I think he has that power already.
Mm-hmm.
And if you want to strengthen that to, in effect, magnify the signal that rising prices give to things like plywood or water or ice or whatever critical commodities there are, depending on the emergency, I think that's fine. But coupled with price controls, I would, again, question whether retailers, no matter how good their intention, can get supplies quickly enough in an emergency when supply and demand really dictate much higher prices to get the attention of the market.
Representative Nelson.
Yes, thank you. Steve, one particular area here that we've studied here in this committee has been the high interest on consumer loans as it relates to payday loans and title loans. But also, I think there is a gouging with fuel, so I guess I don't totally agree with you right now. I mean, maybe the best thing to do is to say, just cut fuel use 20%. But I do think there are some products that and vendors of those products that do constitute gouging. Would you not agree?
Chair Holby, Representative Nelson. The example you're giving, I would read it as not falling under this bill in the sense that it's not a catastrophe, a natural disaster, et cetera. It is, there's all kind of reasons and conditions for the high, I assume even gasoline prices that are not just in Oregon right now, but everywhere. And the idea of conserving is fine, and people will naturally do that to the extent they can because of the high prices. The price sends the signal to conserve. If you have a fixed amount of money to spend on gasoline, for example, you'll get less gasoline because the price is higher. So, again, I understand your concern, but I think what we're talking about here is the government trying to short-circuit the supply and demand laws in a short period. What you're talking about would do it in a long period, and I'm afraid we've seen that sort of thing happen, you know, in the Soviet Union. We're seeing it now in Venezuela. Wherever you have long-term price controls or price and wage controls, you actually hurt consumers. You don't help them.
Thank you. Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I find this type of analysis very interesting, but it calls for making several assumptions, that's what you have to believe, the assumptions to get there. For example, you have to believe that consumers are going to be able and willing to pay unconscionably high prices, and you also have to assume that a product can be brought in, there can be additional supply. But with something like hotel rooms, nobody's going to be bringing in additional hotel rooms, so I don't think that it necessarily applies to everything that's intended by this bill. And also, I think the price controls are reasonable. I think that under your example here, as Representative Riley pointed out, there will be businesses that find more plywood. We're not saying that they have to sell at a loss in this bill. It's just to prevent price gouging. So I'm just saying I don't necessarily agree with the assumptions that you make to get to your analysis, but I find it very interesting.
Interesting. Well, thank you very much for your testimony today. I appreciate you coming forward. I don't believe we have anybody else signed up for Senate Bill 118A. So I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 118A and open a work session on Senate Bill 118A.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 118A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Bonamici moves Senate Bill 118A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Seeing.
Oh, I don't want to open this up. Go ahead. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just going to say,
Representative Gilliam.
Thank you. I can't support this bill. I just think that it's got some great intentions, but it's just way overkill for a situation that doesn't exist. Thank you.
Yeah. Representative Nelson.
Mr. Chair, I'm going to support this bill because I've been in several situations where definitely price gouging has really encumbered my constituents as well as my own family. So I know it happens, and I appreciate having the opportunity to protect my constituents and my family in times of great catastrophes.
Thank you. Any other comments?
I'm just going to explain my vote, and it's going to be a very loud no, because I believe in economics, and I think that the minute that we interfere in the economics of the state, that we do get just what was explained. You get a decrease in supply, not an increase in supply, and I don't agree with Representative Riley that you're going to necessarily get more plywood or the plywood you need, because you have an increase in demand for that plywood, and you have to have increased supply, and that supply has to come somewhere, and that increased supply will come with increased price. So, I don't know. And I just think that it goes way, way too far.
Representative Galizio.
Well, while we're getting somewhat philosophical, I think the notion that somehow the market is separate from government is might for some be utopian, but it's not reality. Even Wall Street has triggers when you get a precipitous drop in prices or something. So this notion that there's this sort of pure market that exists anywhere, some might wish that were true, but that's not the case. And so and I think the Cascade Policy Institute would think that the only reason for government is have a military, and so they would have no government looking at the health of, you know, the food supply or anything. And if that's the kind of world you want to live in, fine. But the reality is the market and government are interdependent, and they exist, and it's a difficult balance, and it's often unbalanced. But That's the reality in which we live. And again, I would just go back to the Wall Street analogy and say, this is a bill for an emergency situation, and it's not going to cause these disastrous consequences or unintended consequences that are claimed. So I'll be an eye.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And since we're doing this, I'll add my explanation about why I support the bill. And I see this as a safeguard to protect consumers in a very rare instance of extreme emergency, which is, I think, when people are already in a very stressed and vulnerable situation, it's not a time to be profiting on their backs in a time of severe emergency. So that's why I'm supporting the bill. I don't expect that it will be used very often, if at all, but it's a tool that we need to have to protect Oregonians.
Thank you. Another comment, Representative Nelson?
I just wanted to say the difference between Senate Bill 118 and the engrossed bill, adds more specifics and, establishing a timeline for the automatic termination of the declaration and providing for extension by, subsequent declarations and exempting electric utilities and certain public utilities. I felt we took care of this and that this problem does exist because I really don't believe our Attorney General would be requesting this on behalf of the Department of Justice if this had not occurred or you see it occurred and knows our citizens need some protection.
Thank you. And, I guess I might as well comment, too. It seems to me that, Representative Riley, do you want to comment?
Nope.
Okay, good. Well, it just seems to me this really doesn't enter into supply and demand this bill by itself. It seems that it has to be triggered by the abnormal disruption of the market caused by some catastrophic event, and in that case, I think it is a great protection for folks because, like Representative Nelson, I have seen price gouging happen as well. So with that, Mr. Riley, can you call the long-awaited roll?
Representative Galizio?
Aye.
Representative Gilliam?
No.
Representative Girard?
Nope.
Representative Riley?
Aye.
Representative Bonamici?
Aye.
Representative Nelson?
Aye.
Chair Holdies?
Aye. Senate Bill 118A, having received the majority votes, is declared passed and moves to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Are you sure on those numbers?
No, I'm just kidding. Which ones?
What number?
No. Would anybody like to carry this bill on the floor?
I think this would be a lot of fun.
Yeah, I do too.
I look forward to Jerry Crummell's questions. Absolutely.
Representative Galizio, it's yours.
It'll be a great day.
And I'll back you up.
You have a lot of fun.
With that, did I close the work session already? I closed the work session on Senate Bill 118A, again, if I already did, and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 122A. Steve, give us a reminder of Senate Bill 122A.
Senate Bill, thank you, Chair Holvey. Senate Bill 122 specifies as unlawful trade practice the mailing or causing to be sent a check, draft, or other payment instrument that, when deposited or cashed, creates a payment obligation in the depositor, of the depositor or payee.
Thank you, and we...
And you have the dash A2 amendments, which were what Mr. Dewey had talked to the committee about during our last meeting.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. With that, I'll have Mike Dewey and Andrew Scholl. Or you can come up separately or together. It doesn't matter to me. Pro con.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mike Dewey, representing the Department of Dar. We worked very well together on 118, so I just want you to know we can
All right.
we can do these kind of things.
That's encouraging.
It is encouraging. Thank you, Mr. Chair. If you may, I know there's some interest in moving Senate Bill 122. I had mentioned at the previous hearing that I had some amendments that were being drafted, and when the amendments came out, I called my client, and it's not – LC was provided the language that we wanted, and LC provided that to me, and so they did their work, and I said, I don't think this goes as far as you want it to go in terms of disclosure and how you deal with somebody that cashes the check. And I had received back from my client the information that was needed, and I provided that information to LC to provide an amendment. And I would ask, Mr. Chair, if I could, I can explain what the amendment does, but I do not have the, if you will, the legal form before us today, and I'd like to be able to get it to you and discuss it further. Well, so it's really up to you as to...
Yeah, Mr. Dewey, why don't you tell us what this proposed amendment does? I mean, we have your Dash 2 amendment. Is it much different than the Dash 2, or what?
It is significantly different. For example, I'll just give you an example. On line... what we would propose on line 6... It says, and this is significant, for goods or services promoted by means of the check may not bill the cost. So when I read this, I said, I don't think to my client this does and does not go as far as you would want it to go. So there are some specific examples about an invoice and examples about getting, if you will, credit cards. So there's or a debit card, so the person has to provide that to you. So I would argue that I think with regard to reining in these companies, if that's the choice, the amendment that we would offer up that you do not have before you because it's not yet ready, and I wish it were, but it's not, that's why I would like to see if we could wait until the next meeting because I'm sure it would be available at that point in time.
Mr. Chair, can I ask a question?
Okay, go ahead. I'm still trying to figure out what the Dash A3 does.
Thank you. That's what I wanted to clarification. What is it that your proposed amendment is going to do that this one doesn't?
Well, basically, and this is just handwritten, if you will, so I will go through this. I didn't provide it to you because it was a fax to me, and it's hard to read. And so basically what it does is it speaks to, and I'll read the entire, if I may, Mr. Chair, Section 1. It's a short paragraph. A person that offers through the mail or by other means a check, the cashing or depositing of which obligates the endorser or payee identified in the check to pay for goods or services promoted by the means of the check may bill the cost. Now it says may not bill the cost of the goods or services promoted to the account where the check was deposited or to any other of the endorser or payee's existing consumer account. So it literally goes the opposite direction. This says that you may, our amendment says you may not do this. And then it goes on to say, and the language is from there on, is almost the same, other than we provide for a new Section 3. We have on line 15, there would be a new Section 3, and then there would be a new Section 4 on line 19 of page 2. So it changes the way in terms of how they can do that. And then it gets, of course, into the new Section 3. It deals with the invoice and so forth.
Representative Riley.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair. The way you read the new Section 1, I don't see how it differs from the original bill because the way I heard what you said, cashing that check would not obligate you to anything. You'd get an invoice. They would contact you again, and then I'm not sure what that does.
Well, I think it's significant because it says may not bill the cost of the goods or service is promoted, and then you go to Section 2 of the bill, my Section 2, that speaks to then the protocol of what you do with a credit card, what you do with a debit card that the person is obviously providing. So I see that there's, if you will, Mr. Chair, I think there's a, in my mind, there's a significant difference.
Follow up, Representative Riley.
Okay. In the original bill, it says that you can't send a check, the signing of which obligates the person who signs it and cashes it. And if I understand what you're saying in your bill, the obligation also does not occur until some other action has taken place. Is that correct, or am I putting something in there that's not in there?
I think, Mr. Chair and Representative Riley, you are correct in terms of they have obligated themselves, but there are then certain requirements that you have to meet.
Have and obligated right. themselves.
Okay. Yeah, no, I would agree to that
okay.
reference.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Bonamici.
Thank you. I have a question that doesn't have to do with the actual language of the A2 or your proposed amendment. If your client has something that they want to sell, why can't they just say to the consumer, if you want this, order it or buy it? Why do they have to send them something that's a check? Why do they have to pay them to buy something?
Mr. Chair and Representative Bonamici, I'm not in this business, and so I will be as frank as I possibly can be here. I think it's pretty clear that these kinds of promotions work for certain people. And I mean, it's one of those situations where I would think somebody that would look at this and say, 4X, then I'm obligated to do something else. And as I said, the entity that I represent is not doing this, but we are always for, if we can, for disclosure, as opposed to saying there's something you may not do in Oregon state law. But I think it's really a matter of, as I use the analogy of campaigning, it's these are promotions that evidently work, but they ought not to be misleading. And I want to make that very clear here today, that we want to do it. I mean, the information needs to be clear and conspicuous. You need to know what you're being obligated for.
Representative Galizio, question?
Yes. I wish you hadn't reminded me of campaigning. That's me. So in using Representative Riley's simple or plain language?
Plain
language. The goal of a dash three, or the goal of an amendment, let's call it the dash three, is to provide increased disclosure to the recipient. Is that the primary goal of an amendment, would be to increase disclosure? And if that's true, well, I'll stop there.
Representative Hovey and Representative Galizia, I've learned an awful lot about this in the last couple of days, and hopefully I'll forget about it shortly. There are other things on my mind too. So it's my understanding that we have situations where, and it's hard for me to believe this, but somehow when you endorse a check, somehow you are the whatever you signed up for ends up on your phone bill, or it can end up on your mortgage.
That's right.
And that ought not to happen, because I don't understand that. I don't understand why anybody would do that. That's clear and misleading, and I think that Section 1 takes care of that. But that's an issue that I understand has come up in states. I haven't read the consent decree with the company that was involved with the AG, but nonetheless, that's occurred, so we wanted to, one, make sure that could not happen, at least in Oregon. Secondly, we wanted to make sure that with regard to where you endorsed it, there was information that you're obligated to do. Third, we wanted to make sure that if you canceled, there was a process by which that would occur, and in this information that you received, you knew exactly where to go and how you could cancel.
And then we have some language that speaks to the invoice and what, if there is an invoice, it's very clear and conspicuous as to what are the terms and conditions on that. So people know again what it is, and then the opportunity to cancel. So that's what we're trying to do, as opposed to a, if you will, a strict prohibition.
Mr. Chair, could I just ask who gave us the dash twos? You know where they came from?
Mr. Dewey.
Oh.
Yeah. I received Representative Nelson, Mr. Chair. This is a quick-moving process here, and we offered up the dash twos. But when I read the dash twos, and it's not legislative council, it's just the information that I was given, I said, I don't think this does what you want it to do. So that's why I anticipate a dash three, depending on what the committee does.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Bonamici.
Thank you. I know this is, we're in public hearing, or are we in work session?
We're in public hearing. Okay.
So I'll try to make this into a question. When Mr. Dewey talked about how these promotions work, unfortunately, who they work for are the most vulnerable consumers. And when the consent, I looked at an article about the consent decree. Consumers were never told that by signing it, they had agreed to pay for membership. The victims were mostly seniors and people with limited use of the English language. And anybody who gets these checks that are between $2 and $10, and those are if they really need that $2 or $10, they're tempted by the promotion to sign it. And I think that that's not the right way to market to the most vulnerable in our society. And if the companies have something worthwhile to sell, they should sell it, and the consumer should make the choice freely without being tempted by signing a check that they don't necessarily understand to buy the product.
Thank you. Any other comments? I think I need to give Mr. Shola a chance to speak. He's been sitting patiently, and I'd just like to hear from his side before we move on.
Certainly much more.
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, thank you. For the record, Andrew Scholl, Oregon Department of Justice, Financial Fraud, Consumer Protection Section. Mr. Dewey and our office had great discussions on Senate Bill 118, and it was professional and it was productive, and so I hope you won't take this personal. The issue we had with an earlier suggested amendment was that it made the bill a disclosure bill instead of a prohibition. What the Attorney General is asking for is a legislative choice in policy to prohibit this type of check in Oregon.
And I'm not offended by that whatsoever.
Excuse me.
Representative Nelson.
So, Mr. Scholl, what really, then, is the matter with the original 122 amended? I mean, if you're looking at it.
Chair Holvey, Representative Nelson, if you're talking about 122A,
uh-huh.
Absolutely nothing.
That's the
that's
way it should
our
be.
Bill that came out of the Senate with consensus amendments.
Okay.
Thank you. Any other questions?
Well, I just want to, could I please?
Representative Nelson.
Yes, well, I have great respect for Mr. Dewey, so I just want to say.
As we all do.
Yes. We all do. We do.
I see something coming here. Go ahead.
Well, I'm just looking at this, and I'm just saying, you know, I can't imagine there being clients that wouldn't concur with 122A because it's just good business. Prudent.
Again, clients don't do this. They don't. Mr. Chair and Representative Nelson, I respect your opinion. I think the AG's office has put it in a very good light. They would like to prohibit this activity.
Yeah.
The folks, and I'm in that camp from time to time on the direct marketing side. How far do you go? And so in our view, it's best to provide as much disclosure as you can, because at some point in time you have to kind of draw that line. And you know, what has occurred with certain promotions, I have disdain for those. No matter what we do, it's not going to be perfect. But my client likes disclosure over prohibitions. It's a public policy here, and we will respect what you do.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions for these two? Appreciate you coming up and letting us run through the A2A3 sort of amendment. And I think with that, is there anybody else that wishes to testify on Senate Bill 122A?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Seeing none, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 122A and open a work session on Senate Bill 122A.
Yeah, okay. Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 122A to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Representative Bonamici moves Senate Bill 122A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Nelson.
I could not believe this. But after we discussed this bill last week, I went home and had two of these in my mail. I was going to bring them today, and it just made me mad. I was glad it was me instead of my 83-year-old mother, though.
Yeah.
Couldn't believe it.
I didn't send them to you.
You didn't?
No.
Okay.
So, any other discussion?
We're not going to wait for the A3 amendments.
There's a motion.
We have a motion on the floor.
I just wanted to comment. I think Mr. Dewey pretty adequately explained what they would do. I think we were able to consider them. They weren't that different from the Dash 2 ones.
And seeing the policy difference between the prohibition and the disclosure aspect of it, I think that's the policy decision before us. And that is the motion on the table. Mr. Riley, would you call the roll?
Representative
Galizia?
Aye.
Representative
Gilliam?
Aye.
Representative Gerard?
Aye.
Representative Riley?
Aye.
Representative
Bonamici?
Aye. Representative Nelson?
Aye.
Chair Holby?
Aye.
Yeah.
Senate Bill 122A.
I'd be happy to carry that.
Having received the majority votes, it declare pass and moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Representative Riley has offered to carry that bill on the floor. With that, I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 122A.
Representative.
Oh. next up.
Unsigned.
With that, I would like to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 447. Yeah, it was a little refreshing.
Did you endorse it?
Steve, give us a little prelim on Senate Bill 447, please.
Thank you, Chair Holby. Senate Bill 447 broadens the scope of the crime of identity theft.
That works. I have Tim Martinez scheduled to testify, signed up, in the first slot.
There's more than one slot.
The first time he's speaking.
Yeah, it's been a long time since coming to have you in front of our committee.
It's a pleasure to be here, Mr. Chairman. Tim Martinez here on behalf of the Oregon Bankers Association. Thank you for hearing Senate Bill 447. I'm about to give you something, all of you, it's very precious this time of year, and that's 20 minutes of free time, because if I'm still up here at 2:35, I've done something wrong. As you can see from this bill, it makes a very small change with something that we think is very critical in the crime of identity theft. What we're seeing a growing trend in is not stealing your information or my information anymore. It's stealing our grandparents and our deceased relatives, because nobody's tracking that information. It is a huge, as I say, one of the growth areas in identity theft, and it's a small bill that we would like to see the legislature enact. The bankers have been involved in identity theft legislation for at least the last four or five sessions. We've helped pass bills to increase penalties. We're working with Senator Prezansky and many more this time around on Senate Bill 583, which you will hopefully see here in the next few days. But we would encourage you to adopt 447. when you see fit to schedule it for a work session. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Martinez. Any questions from the committee? Representative Riley.
Comment. Good bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Riley.
Representative Gerard.
I actually have a question for the chair. Why didn't this go to judiciary and why did it come here?
Why did it come here?
Yeah.
Because we're more confident.
This is a consumer issue.
I don't know about that.
Be careful. I just find it really ironic.
It's my opinion.
I think
it's a consumer. But I think it's a good bill.
I think it's because we're getting the other identity theft bill.
Well, I know.
I think if you really are curious about that, you should go talk to the speaker.
And he and I like this.
There's just too many bills to judiciary.
You know.
I agree with
so,
Representative Jones,
I don't make the call. I just do my job.
This bill would be dead in judiciary.
Yeah, they'd probably kill it.
Dead.
It'd be a crime to introduce it there.
Any legitimate questions for Mr. Martinez so we don't waste his time with frivolity.
Sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Martinez, for coming forward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
This looks like a great bill. And
very good.
We will end up moving this, but not today. With that, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 447.
Let's move the bill.
I know, we should have.
We didn't advertise a work.